Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Daniel Trachewski, a member of the Club Science and Technology and Health and Medicine member-led forums and chairman of this program. The club's program tonight is entitled Reverse Engineering of the Human Brain. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest speaker, Professor Jack Gallant, or Gallant. Let me tell you a little bit about Jack, or Dr. Gallant. Jack Gallant is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's affiliated with the graduate programs in bioengineering, biophysics, neuroscience, and vision science. He received his PhD from Yale University and did postdoctoral work at the at Caltech and the Washington University Medical School. His research program focuses on constructing quantitative computational models that accurately describe how the brain encodes information during natural tasks and to use these models to decode information in the brain in order to reconstruct mental experiences. This computational framework can be used to understand and decode brain activity measured by different methods, such as functional MRI, near-infrared spectroscopy, electro-EEG, and ECOG. It'll be easier to say it that way, and so on. So at this point, I'm going to have Professor Gallant come up and give us the talk.
Thanks very much, Dan, for that kind introduction, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me, and especially thank all of you for coming out on a Monday night. I heard Sonia Sotomayor's talk was fully sold out, so I expect that's why you're here, but I really appreciate it anyway. I'm a professor of psychology, but most of my work is very computational, and the main problem that we study in my lab is the problem of representation. How does the brain represent information about the world, and how does it represent information about the brain's own internal states? Now, that's kind of a big, vague kind of problem, and rather than think about how to attack this problem, I thought it would be a little easier to pick a smaller target. So I thought I would try talking mostly about decoding or focusing on decoding. And in this case, the problem is, how could we build a device that would allow us to decode information from the brain and sort of look at what is in there or what someone is thinking? If that was possible, it would have a lot of really interesting and really kind of scary implications. But most importantly, it would tell us that we actually understand how the brain operates. So to give you a little example, I thought I'd play a short clip from a recent episode of House that came out a couple years ago. Some of you may have seen this, where they have a patient who is in a state. They don't really understand what's wrong with her. It seems to be that perhaps there's some latent memory that is interfering with her or normal function or causing seizures, and they decide to use a brain decoding method to try to figure out what's going on in her subconscious.
Cognitive pattern recognition is 50 years from being a useful diagnostic tool.
Even if we can get the equipment, it takes hours for the initial mapping. If she has another seizure, she could strike out.
I'm not telling a mother who's scared out of her mind that our best shot is a magic trick.
It's not magical, it's experimental. It's like washing your hands after pooping once was.
Okay, so here we have the patient. She's lying in some sort of brain reading device, and she's watching
something
videos.
Specific?
Like what?
Doesn't matter, just make it a single image.
And so now she starts to imagine something, and they try to decode her brain activity.
What are you thinking?
About Nick playing baseball?
Holy crap.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Now all we have to do is read her subconscious and hope that it's completely rational when we're at the med school.
Does anything get you excited?
So the usual house droll humor. But the interesting thing about this episode is, although this is kind of a very science fiction-y kind of thing to think about, we can actually do this today. In fact, this episode of House came out about 6 months after our first results were announced, where we decoded brain activity and reconstructed natural movies that people had watched using MRI. So the writers of House actually did a really good job of showing you kind of how this system would work, although they used a different technology than I would use to solve the problem. All the math is exactly the same. So for the rest of the talk, I thought first I'd talk about how you could actually solve this sort of problem. If you wanted to build a decoder, what would you do? And the approach that we take in my lab is called reverse engineering. I'll explain how that works and why it's called that. Then I'm going to talk about how we apply the reverse engineering approach to understand how certain parts of the brain function. In particular, I'll focus on vision and how visual information is modulated by attention and intentions of people. And then I'll talk a bit about language. And finally, at the end, I'll show some results of decoding that we've gotten recently from the lab over the past few years. And if everything is mysterious up to that point, at the end, when the decoding results are shown, I hope you will be impressed and appreciate that the system actually works. So unfortunately, this is kind of a high-tech approach, and it's going to require dealing with some methods at the beginning. So fasten your seatbelts. If the methods kind of pass over you, really, they're not that important. They're mostly for the aficionados, but I feel like I have to include them for completeness. Don't feel bad if not everything makes immediate sense. So let's first think about the problem here. We want to reverse engineer the brain. So the brain, we all know, is whatever the heck it is, it's pretty complicated. How are you going to approach this problem? Well, the first thing you do, you might say, is, well, let's think of it in terms of an analogy to a chip. So on the left here, you see an Intel Pentium CPU, and on the right, a brain. The Intel Pentium CPU is a pretty complicated device, but at least it's designed with some clear principles in mind, right? Some engineer went and designed this chip. He laid it out in a certain form. You can actually get an idea of what the parts are. Of course, it's made of a bunch of transistors, but you can see that the transistors are aligned in clear subunits. And if you wanted to try to reverse engineer this system, you'd probably go in and try to attack the individual subunits and figure out what they do. And in principle, you might be able to do that. It would take you, of course, a really long time. But it's possible. On the right, we have the brain, and that's a much more difficult problem because the brain wasn't designed. It evolved, and we don't know what the constraints were that drove evolution. We also don't know what the functional units are. Of course, the brain is, at a fundamental level, made up of neurons. There's about 100 billion neurons in the human brain, but these neurons are arranged in circuits, and nobody really has a good idea of what most of the circuitry is in the brain or how the neurons function as circuit units. So that part's kind of mysterious. On top of it all, the brain has another very strange property that kind of constrains how you think about the brain and how to attack it, and that's that the hardware constrains the software. So on a normal computer, we have a piece of hardware that can run any possible program. So you have a CPU on your computer. It can run Word, Microsoft Word at one point, and then you can, you know, look at YouTube videos, whatever the CPU will handle it. And it handles that by loading up completely different software programs with a constant piece of hardware. In your brain, actually, everything is constrained by the hardware because all you have is information flowing over the wires that are represented by the neurons. And since information is flowing over these fixed wires, you actually can't change the software program on a short term. You can change it in a long term by growing a new wire, but it actually takes about 20 minutes or 30 minutes to grow a new synapse in the brain. So within about 20 minutes, you only have one brain. It is completely fixed, and there's nothing you can do about it. Now, of course, you're not thinking the same thing for 20 minutes. You can dynamically allocate your attention and start thinking about different things very rapidly, but you're doing it with a fixed piece of hardware. It's just that the hardware has a special kind of circuitry that allows it to be flexible in thought, even though the hardware itself is fixed. So the point of this is that there's a very close and tight association between the software and the hardware in the brain. So if we want to try to reverse engineer the brain, we can think of three separate problems that we are going to have to solve. First, what kind of data do we need in order to be able to reverse engineer it? What method should we use to collect the data? And how should we interpret the data and build models once we have the data? And I'll deal with each of those three quickly. What kind of data should we collect? Well, I told you a second ago that the brain has a very close association between hardware and software, right? The software that is running on your brain is essentially constrained completely by the wires. So if you wanted to understand brain function, one approach you could take is just to ignore the function and just try to figure out what the wiring is. And in fact, there's several groups in the world trying to do this. There's a huge multi-billion dollar project in the U.S. called the Human Connectome Project. You can look it up on the internet. There's also a project that's probably going to be funded in Europe for $1 billion called the Blue Brain Project, and these are both aimed at trying to understand the wiring diagram of the brain. The wiring diagram of a typical brain is shown here on the left. This uses something called diffusion MRI, and you can see that there are pathways here that go from one location in the brain to another. Unfortunately, my laser pointer does not work on this display, so I'll just try to describe it. You can see that there are different pathways of certain colors that represent wires in white matter that are projecting information from one part of the brain to a different part of the brain. And in principle, if you knew all of the wires in the entire brain and you knew their biophysical properties, you could actually completely model the brain on an actual general computer, and you would know everything there is to know about the brain because hardware and software are the same thing. The problem, though, is, of course, we don't really have a way to recover all of the wiring information in the brain. If there are 100 billion neurons and each neuron is connected to a few thousand other neurons, there are probably a trillion connections in the brain. We simply have no way to map those out. So although getting structural information is a great idea, in practice it's not going to get us very far for the foreseeable future until we get much better ways of getting hardware information, the structural information. So the other thing you can do is say, okay, I'm going to ignore the hardware completely, even though this is a system that's completely constrained by the hardware, and I'm going to collect data about function. And that's shown on the right here. This is a functional MRI map. It's just one frame. And red means more brain activity, and blue means less brain activity in response to some stimulus. And so we could measure the brain somehow and collect lots of brain activity data and try to model the relationship between measured brain function and the world and build our model that way. And that's the approach that I favor, simply because you can make progress more quickly than trying to recover structural information and map it onto function that way. So when we're recording functional information, we still have to keep track of the fact that underneath the function, there is some hardware. And this hardware is organized at multiple scales. So the individual cells in the brain that transmit information between themselves and other cells are called neurons. A few neurons are shown at the upper left. On a large scale, the brain is organized into areas. There are subcortical nuclei, there are areas on the surface of cortex, and the number of areas in the brain is thought to be maybe about on the order of 300 or so. These are essentially different processing modules that process different kinds of information. And then the link between individual neurons, the 100 billion neurons in the 300 brain areas, is between cortical columns and maps. So individual neurons are organized into cortical columns. The columns are about a millimeter across in humans, so that means there's going to be about 50 to 100,000 columns in the neocortex. And then these columns are arranged into maps that systematically represent different kinds of information depending on where they are in the brain, and those maps essentially define the areas. So if we are doing animal studies, we can actually record information on any of these scales. But if we're doing human studies, until recently, we were pretty much left with aerial-based measurements. We could find out what the brain areas were, but we couldn't find any more fine-scale information about what was going on within those areas. And the method I'll talk about today kind of begins to get us past that problem. So now we have to come up with a method for recovering brain activity and for measuring it. And there's really two broad approaches you can take. The first is electroencephalography, or its sister methods, such as you might have heard of MEG. Some of you might have gone to the doctor and had an EEG at some point. It's a cap that you wear on your head. The image at the left is actually an EEG-based pinball machine, which I'm showing just because I thought it was amazingly cool. It was built by a group in Germany a couple years ago. It's actually pretty easy to build an EEG-based pinball machine because it only has to flip the flippers, and that's a sort of low-dimensional signal, right? EEG is a great method. It records neural activity. Neurons are electrical. They emanate electrical fields. By putting a cap on the person's head, we can record those electrical fields at a distance and make inferences about what's going on in the brain. So it is recording neurons. That's a great advantage of the method. It records the neural activity at a very high rate of speed. So an individual neuron can fire up to can transmit information up to about 100 times per second, and all that information is potentially available to you in EEG. It's also really cheap and simple to use. The problem with EEG, however, is that the brain does not like to emanate electrical signals. So if you're wearing this electrical cap, what happens is the skull filters out most of the information in the brain before it actually gets to the electrical cap. So you have this sort of very coarse, low-pass information, and you don't get a lot of the neural information that you see that you need. The second big problem with EEG is that it requires, in order to use EEG, it requires solving something called the inverse problem. Remember, EEG occurs on a two-dimensional cap. So your brain is a three-dimensional volume. And the trouble is inferring where in the brain something happened when you're only measuring on this two-dimensional cap is actually an under-constrained problem, because you have to map from a two-dimensional surface back into a three-dimensional volume. And there's actually no unique solution for that. So EEG, although it's in theory a great method, in practice, it's really kind of lousy. And you really can't use it for much. And if you wonder why aren't there people wandering around with EEG-controlled wheelchairs, since really in a wheelchair you just have to kind of go left, right, backwards, and forwards, the reason is EEG is so bad you can't actually make an EEG-controlled wheelchair. And you would think that would be the first application of this technology, right? So another way you can measure brain activity is with functional MRI. Functional MRI uses a large stationary magnet. The magnet shown here on the right is actually a head-only magnet. It's actually fairly small compared to many MRI machines. Lots of times an MRI machine is a body MRI machine that you have to slide into and you completely disappear in the middle of the tube. Many of you may have had an MRI at some point. MRI is a great technology in some respects and lousy in others. MRI is actually measuring magnetic properties of the body rather than electrical. And unfortunately, it does not measure electrical activity of the brain. It measures changes in blood flow, blood oxygenation, and blood volume that occur due to neural activity. So neurons, you can think of as little engines, and they have to extract oxygen and sugar from the bloodstream, and they use the oxygen to burn the sugar to make this magical substance called ATP that they use to run their little engines. And when they extract oxygen and sugar from the bloodstream, it changes the concentration of oxygen in the bloodstream. And we can actually use MRI to measure those changes in oxygenation. So we're getting an echo of what the brain's doing with MRI, but we're not getting a direct measure of neural activity. So usually when you hear me talk about MRI, I won't say we're measuring neural activity. I'll say we're measuring brain activity. It's brain activity of some sort, just not the sort we would measure if we had a better technique. The advantage of MRI is that it has really good spatial resolution. In fact, MRI actually measures in three dimensions. So MRI essentially divides the brain up into a giant three-dimensional grid and measures the blood flow at individual points through the brain. These points are called voxels for volumetric pixels. They're about the size of a pea. And they're going to be, say, 100,000 voxels in a typical brain. So in MRI, you're measuring 100,000 points in three dimensions. You don't have to solve the inverse problem. Of course, because you're measuring blood flow changes and blood oxygenation changes are much slower than electrical activity. So MRI has fantastic spatial resolution and lousy temporal resolution. EEG has great temporal resolution and lousy spatial resolution. So this is like a contest between space and time, which wins? Well, it turns out space is much more important for understanding the brain than time. And the reason has to do with the folds. You notice the brain is very, very folded. And you can think of, if you think about two brain structures that are on opposite sides of a sulcus, those two brain structures might be doing very, very different things. But if we're measuring from an EEG electrode at the surface, these two parts of the brain that are doing very, very different things get mixed together spatially, and we can't ever take them apart. If we have MRI data that records at a fine enough spatial resolution that we can get information from each side of the sulcus directly, then we don't have to worry about this mixing problem because we can see uniquely what each part of the brain does. So space, because the brain is crunched up inside your skull so that your head is small enough so that your mother could give birth to you, that's really the reason, right? Because your head is crunched up inside your skull, space turns out to be a more important data than time. Okay, so let's look at some MRI data here. On the left, we've got a movie. And on the right, the subjects were just watching this movie in the magnet. On the right, we've got a brain. The brain is inconveniently folded up, so one thing we can do is we can inflate it into kind of a brain-shaped beach ball, and then we can flatten it out. And now we're throwing away the subcortical nuclei and the cerebellum. We're just looking at cortex. And if we do this to your brain, we end up with something about the size of a large pizza. So now brain activity on the map on the right is shown in color. Red means more blood flow, more blood oxygenation, and blue means less blood flow and less blood oxygenation. And you can see that the blood flow is changing quite rapidly while people watch this movie, especially near the middle of the screen. If you notice, here, blood flow is changing quite rapidly, and out here, it's changing fairly slowly. And the reason for this is the visual system is located here. This is the back of the brain. This is the front of the brain. This is the frontal cortex. And because the visual system is in the back, and people are watching movies, we see very rapid changes in blood flow while people watch the movies at the back of the brain. So these are the data we're recording with MRI. Our problem, remember, is to reverse engineer the brain. You may have forgotten about that at this point. So what we need to do is find a systematic relationship between the movies on the left and the maps on the right. And we're measuring about 30,000 points on this cortical surface, 100,000 points in the entire brain, about 30,000 points in this cortical surface. So one way you can think about this problem now is that essentially we have 30,000 models or 30,000 relationships that we have to establish. For each point on the brain, we have to determine what in the movie is making brain activity at that point. For some parts of the visual system, they'll be concerned with simple structural features in the movies, like edges and colors and motions. For other parts of the visual system, they might be concerned with very high-level features in the movies, like is there a little boy, is there a dog, is someone hitting somebody, whatever. And then there are going to be other parts of the brain, like frontal cortex, where you might think about planning and, you might anticipate what's going to happen in the movie and so on. Every part of the brain is going to be different. If we have 300 brain areas, there's going to be 300 different kinds of models that we're going to have to use. Now, this is a horribly ugly slide, I apologize. Remember that we're not sampling the surface of the brain systematically, because we sampled the brain in the 3D grid space, and the cortex is folded up inside this three-dimensional space. So really, if we think of flattening out the brain, we're sampling random points on the surface of the brain, much more densely than here because we have 30,000 points total. So we have these random locations we've sampled at the brain. They have no systematic relationship with any brain structures other than cortex or any known area or anything because they're just randomly sampled. So this presents kind of a problem because we don't necessarily know a priori what any one of these points should do, what its brain function is. Now, we can take advantage in this sense of prior information that people have gained from previous brain studies. So this is, again, a flat map, but if you notice on this flat map, there are little white outlines. And those little white outlines, I hope you can see them, because I have to be honest, I can't see them from here. The little white outlines show different brain areas. And across the entire brain, our guess is there are probably something like 300 brain areas, and these tile the surface of the brain like pepperonis on a pizza, right? And every single brain area does something different. But we only know of, functionally, maybe 20 or 30 of these areas, and the rest of them are unknown. So if we sample a point that falls in an area that we have a clue about, like we know it's in the visual system or we know it's in the language system, we might be able to constrain our modeling effort by building a vision model for vision points or a language model for language points. But if the point that we're sampling falls in between the white boundaries where we don't know what the function of that part of the brain is very well, then it's going to be very, very difficult to model. All right. For those of you who do not care how we do this, please shut off your brain for 2 seconds, because the next two slides are complicated. This shows the data analysis pipeline that we use in the lab. Sorry, I just realized I can see my slide a little better if I do this. This shows the data analysis pipeline that we use in the lab. First, we collect some data. And the data usually uses natural tasks, like people could be watching movies, or they could be listening to stories in the magnet, and we collect 2 data sets. One data set we use to fit the models, and then the other data set we use to predict brain activity. So we fit a model on the first half of the data set, say somebody would watch, Roy Rogers, and then on the second half of the movie they would watch, Temple of Doom, and we would try to use the models we fit for Roy Rogers to predict Temple of Doom. That's the basic idea, right? So the advantage of this is prediction framework is that we're really trying to explain all of the brain activity. We're trying to build a forward model where we're predicting brain activity from the movies. This is called an encoding model. We haven't gotten to the brain decoding stage yet. Now, in the second stage, once we have the data collected, we just start fitting models. We have 30,000 points in the brain, so we have 30,000 points that we have to model, but we don't know what model will fit to any given point. Maybe a language model would be appropriate, maybe a low-level model for vision, maybe a high-level model. So we have dozens of different model frameworks that we can try. We can also try an objective thing. For those of you who know about machine learning, we could use a machine learning algorithm to try to learn the mapping between the stimulus and the brain response directly, not knowing anything about the model. There are a lot of algorithms we can use. Basically, any kind of regression algorithm is fair game. Once we have a model that predicts well, then we can visualize our results. We can look at individual points in the brain and see what they're tuned for. We can look at the collection of points in the brain and see kind of how the brain organizes information. And then after we do all of that, we can do decoding. And it turns out, as you'll see, that decoding is completely trivial at this point. Because once we have an encoding model that accurately predicts, decoding is simply a quick inversion of the model by something called Bayes' theorem. I'm going to skip that slide because it's even worse. All right. So now let's go to modeling visual areas. We began this project by looking at vision because vision is by far the simplest part of the brain. Vision is like you open your eyes and you see. It's not really that simple, of course. There are actually 50 or 60 different visual areas, but compared to everything else in the brain, vision is simple. There's almost a straight shot from the retina through LGN to cortex, and then information goes out to these various visual areas in cortex. For audition, it's much more complicated. Information goes in the cochlea, percolates along in subcortical nuclei for a while, and then goes up to cortex. The frontal lobes, if we think about modeling the frontal lobes, where we have planning and intention and long-term memory and value and attitudes, well, that's, you know, completely mysterious, right? So vision is kind of the easiest part of the brain to model. If this is going to be successful at all, that's where we're going to be able to model it. So, as I said, vision consists of many different areas. There are, in non-human primates, something on the order of maybe 40 visual areas. Humans probably have all of those, plus a bunch of visual areas that are involved in language. So they probably have, guesses are, something like 50 or 60 different visual areas. And each visual area does its own job. You can think of them as being divided into three classes. There are early visual areas that represent really simple features in the scenes, like edges and local patches of motion and color. And then there are high-level visual areas that represent the semantic content of the scene, like, you know, was it your grandmother, was it your father, whatever. And then there are these intermediate visual areas that have to map between the low-level representations and the high-level representations. And the reason you have those areas is that vision is kind of under constraint. How you do object vision depends on what your intention is. So at one point, you can sort of pay attention to my whole body. And another point, without moving your eyes, you can just pay attention to my head. And the higher level representation of the visual world in those two cases is different, even though the low level input is the same. So you need a flexible mechanism for dividing up the world, for segmenting and grouping the little surface patches and pixels to put them together to do high level vision. Instead of showing you about all the vision models, I'm just going to show you a high-level vision model because I think it's very accessible. So this model is intended to describe how the higher-level vision parts of your brain do object categorization. And what we're really trying to do here is model nouns and verbs. So some part of your brain, you know, knows that I can look out on the audience here and I can see there's a bunch of men in the front row and there are some women in the second row and there's some chairs and there's a clock and I can name all these objects. Somewhere in my brain, that information is represented. So how we would build a model to actually find where that information is represented? Well, the first thing we need is something called a feature space or a model framework. And fortunately for nouns and verbs, we have a convenient way to represent nouns and verbs. It's called WordNet. It's shown here as this tree. This is actually an inheritance hierarchy, or what's known as an is a hierarchy, of all the nouns and verbs in the English language. I'm only showing you 17 of them here, but there's millions of nouns and verbs in WordNet. So at the base of the tree, which I think is maybe here, this is thing. Every noun is a thing. Then if you go out here, you have organism. And then if you branching off of organism is animal and person. Branching off of person is, you know, little boy, little girl, doctor, lawyer, athlete. Branching off of animal is reptiles, birds, fish, mammals, rodents, and you can see that this just gets finer and finer distinctions, right? It's just like inheritance hierarchy. There are separate trees for the communication verbs, for traveling verbs, movement verbs, and so on. Every verb has its own tree. So as I said, this representation has millions of nouns and verbs in it. We only use the 1,700 most common nouns and verbs in the English language for reasons that will become obvious in a second. Now, what are we going to do with this? This doesn't have anything to do with the brain. This is more some weird linguistic tool. Well, the idea is to use this tool to systematically look at what's happening in the brain. So now we need to fit this model to the brain. And the way we do this is we first go through the movies and we code all of the nouns and verbs that appear in the movies. So if there's a woman in a movie, then we know that there's a female, and we know that there's a human, and we know that there's a mammal, and we know that there's a thing, for example. And we can do that for all the one-second clips of the movie. So now we've translated the movie from being pixels to being this feature space. Basically, we've just coded the presence of objects and nouns in the movie, and now we can try to use those to model the brain. So for each point in the brain, we actually build a model that tells us how much that point in the brain responds to every one of the 1,700 nouns and verbs that appears in the movie. Okay. So if you didn't get anything else, that's really all you need to know. We've got 30,000 points in the brain that we've measured, and for each point in the brain, we're going to figure out how much that point in the brain is affected by the presence or absence of all these 1,700 nouns and verbs. Now, after you fit this model, the very first thing you have to do is you have to see where does the model predict. Because remember, some parts of the brain presumably represent nouns and verbs, but a lot of parts of the brain don't. And we don't want to be wasting our time looking at parts of the brain where this model doesn't fit. So this shows, again, a flat map of the brain. And the colors indicate prediction accuracy. And you can see that certain parts of the brain are really bright yellow. And it turns out that those parts of the brain are the higher order visual system, exactly where we would expect that this kind of information would be represented. These higher order visual system is located in the temporal lobe down by the side of your ear, and it's been known from lots of other research that this is where higher order vision lives. So now that we know that our model's fitting appropriately, we can go and interrogate the model and try to figure out what it's doing. So I'm going to skip that. All right, so this shows the tuning for one location in the brain. It's called a voxel, remember, and this voxel happens to be located in a known brain area called FFA. FFA is the fusiform face area. It's known to be selective for faces. So we can go through and look at one individual location in FFA, and we can plot the responses of this voxel on this tree, and now the balls indicate the little individual nouns and verbs. The size of the ball indicates how much the presence of that noun or verb changes blood flow. The color indicates whether it makes blood flow go up or blood flow go down. So red concepts are things that activate this voxel. More blood is flowing and more oxygen is being used in that voxel. And blue is things that suppress the voxel. So you can see that, although you probably can't see it from here, all these concepts here are faces. These concepts here are communication verbs. These concepts here are animals. These happen to be not all animals, but mammalian animals that also have faces and kind of healing. This voxel is suppressed by all kinds of indoor scenes, vehicles, any kind of artifact, traveling, or most anything else. It's basically a face-selective location of the brain, just as you'd expect from other results. Now, by taking data across multiple subjects and then aggregating those data together, we were able to recover a common space that describes how humans, all humans, represent these 1,700 nouns and verbs. And, you know, this is a big data set. Remember, for each individual person, our data consists essentially of a matrix that's 30,000 locations in the brain by 1,700 concepts. And then we have five subjects. So this is a huge amount of data. Nobody can think about it. So in science, when you're faced with these large data problems, you do something called dimensionality reduction. Dimensionality reduction tries to find a low-dimensional simple space, a simple description of the data that allows you to ignore all the complications and just stick to a few simple concepts. And in this particular data set, we found that these data could be well modeled across people by a four-dimensional space, and that's shown here. So the main takeaway message here is on the right. It's the colored chart. The colored chart shows you which concepts are represented similarly across the brains of all subjects. So again, sorry, my pointer isn't working. Yellow here, these are all animals. So all animals are represented similarly across the brains of all humans. These are all people. People are all represented the same across the brains of humans, except for these little greenish things on the top.
These are athletes. For some reason, your brain represents athletes. This is indoor scenes, outdoor scenes, and structures, building structures. These are represented similarly by the brain. These are vehicles down here in the lower left. These are all represented similarly by the brain. Text, that's a special class that's represented similarly by the brain. So this allows you to sort of take apart how the brain's representing these concepts, and if you notice, these classifications make intuitive sense, right? Oh, you'd expect that your brain would represent pretty much all animals the same. The only weird thing is why athletes are the odd men out in the human category. And I have some thoughts about that. Now, you can also take these data, and you know, this is kind of this has nothing to do with the brain. You know, there's no picture of the brain here. Excuse me, it has to do with the brain, but I'm not showing you anything on the brain. I'm showing you how the brain represents this information. But what we also want to know is how is this information represented on the brain, on the surface of cortex. So to do that, we can take the same color scheme and we can project it onto the surface of cortex. And when we do that, you get something like this. Now, if you remember, green is people, yellow is animals, pink is vehicles, and blue is buildings. And if you noticed, these concepts are represented across huge swaths of the back of the brain. The back of the brain is oriented towards the middle of this slide. The left and right hemisphere are on the left and right, and the back of the brain, the occipital cortex, is in the middle. And you can see that this information is widely distributed across the back of the brain. There's huge amounts of your cortex that are devoted to representing this kind of information. And this is what's going to allow us to decode this information. Because this is widely distributed and has a high level of detail, we are going to be able to make brain readings and then aggregate information across all the points in the brain we record to make a brain decoder. This just shows you the brain representation, the representation of information in three-dimensional space. This is kind of nice because you can see that the yellow animals are kind of separated off on their own, and humans are off on their own. That's in green. And then you notice there's this little kind of stalk sticking out there that seems to be independent of everything else. There's actually two stalks that are sort of sticking vertically. One turns out to be text. Text is represented differently than everything else in your brain. And the other turns out to be, weirdly, atmospheric phenomena, which your brain also considers as some bizarre special thing that's different from everything else. Okay, I'm just going to skip by this quickly. You may wonder, well, how similar are different humans? And it turns out for this kind of visual information, humans represent it very, very similarly. Now, human brains are actually quite variable. Even the primary visual cortex, the earliest, simplest cortical visual area, varies by up to 250% across different people, just like the length of your arm varies. But the organization of this information across different brains is actually very, very consistent across people. This slide simply shows that a low-level model that represents the structural information in movies, like where little motion patches are, where edges are, what their motion is, that's shown in blue here, and you notice that's in the early visual system in the back of the brain. And this higher-level visual information, the category information, is shown in orange, and that's more anterior. So we are seeing the division between low-level and high-level visual information in this kind of modeling framework. I didn't show you the low-level model in the interests of time. Now, I do have a brain viewer, which you can play with. And I do want to mention that because if you don't get anything else out of this talk, at least you can go play with the brain viewer and feel somewhat satisfied. Unfortunately, my brain viewer seems to have burped. Okay, so this brain viewer is available online. It's at my website, camlab.org. And you can just go there and play with it. Here's the brain on the left. It's colored according to this color scheme you saw before. And now you can do two cool things. The first is you can say, well, how are concepts represented? Like, what about crocodiles? Lizards, okay. How are lizards represented in the brain? So we put down lizard. And you notice you can see where lizards are represented in the brain. Red means it likes lizards. Blue means it doesn't like lizards. And of course, the brain's kind of folded up. That's really convenient, so we can inflate the brain. So we can super inflate it, but that's really convenient. You can see how lizards are represented here in the back of the brain, right? They're actually represented quite a lot in the visual system here in the back of the brain. We can click on another concept, like, I don't know, something different. Night. How would a night be represented? Okay, so here's night. You can see that the pattern of brain activity changed quite a lot, and nights are also represented in a lot of places. Now, you can do another thing and say, well, wait a minute, I don't care about concepts here. I want to know what one point in the brain does. So you go over here and click on this point. This happens to be an EBA, which is called the extrastriate body area, because it's thought to represent body parts. Seems like a lot of the brain for that to me, but anyway. Okay, so you can click on here, or not. There we go. So I click on one point in EBA, and now red means this point likes that concept, and blue means the point doesn't like the concept. You can see this point in EBA, it likes all kinds of people. It likes birds, reptiles, fish, carnivores, moving, traveling. It doesn't like vehicles, except that whatever the subset of little buildings is down here. I don't even know what those are. And some very specific vehicles, but mostly not. It's complicated. It's not just bodies. It's a complicated constellation of information. And in fact, that's the take-home message for all this stuff. When you probe the brain really carefully, it's not that one brain area does one thing. It's that one brain area kind of has a central tendency to do one thing, but actually, information is represented and distributed broadly across the brain, and multiple parts of the brain are representing any given concept, and any given part of the brain is representing multiple concepts. And there are representations of multiple kinds of information. So now, in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to language, and I'm going to skip by the attention stuff. Okay. If we wanted to build a brain decoder, like the one I showed you in the House movie, the House video a few minutes ago, really you wouldn't want to do it for video, because who really cares about watching you watch movies, right? I mean, I guess you could have people do visual imagery and like, okay, imagine going to your senior prom and dancing with your date, make a visual image of it, and then I'll try to record that from your brain. Sure, you could do that, but it's not really that useful. If you really wanted to build a brain decoder that was going to be widely used, you would want to decode language, right? In fact, actually what you want to decode is the little person in your head that talks to you all the time. Because if you could build a brain decoder that decoded that, it would replace all brain-machine interfaces ever invented, because why would you bother doing anything else? You just, you know, I'd say, I'd tell my robot, oh, pick up the gavel, and the robot arm would just go over and pick up the gavel, right? Because I can just tell it verbally. I wouldn't need any other kind of brain-machine interface. So, the way you would build such a thing is you do language modeling, and we've done that. Now, language turns out to be represented in the brain very similarly to vision. It's in a different place in the brain. Remember, the visual system is back here. Speech is distributed from here, where auditory cortex is, all the way up here. So speech is in the temporal lobe, and just above the temporal lobe in Wernicke's area, Broca's area, and other constellations of speech areas. And it's kind of broadly distributed, but it's in a very different part of the brain from vision. And speech, just like vision, is represented hierarchically. So at the lowest level, you represent speech according to the power spectrum, the signals going into the cochlea, really low-level spectral signals. But then you represent phonemes, you represent syntax, semantics, and narrative. All those levels of representation must live somewhere in your brain, because you can make judgments about phonemes. Am I saying ba or da? You can make judgments about syntax. Am I using the language correctly? Apparently not. Or you can interpret what I'm saying, or you can follow the narrative over an hour, right? So all that information has to be represented somewhere. So if we want to find out where this information is represented, we can actually fit different models. And this is three different models: a phonemic model, a syntactic model, and a semantic model. And white on this map means the predictions are good for that model, and blue means the predictions are poor. And hopefully you can see that these three models actually fit in different places. The phonemic model fits well in primary auditory cortex, the syntactic model fits well in higher auditory cortex, and also some visual auditory association areas. And the semantic model, which is telling you essentially about what is being said, what the words are, that actually fits really well everywhere. And most importantly, it fits in frontal cortex. And these models were built on data used purely from people listening to stories. We didn't use anything else. So people just listened to stories in the magnet for an hour. These were actually the moth stories. Some of you may listen to the moth on NPR. It's awesomely entertaining, and this is our subject's favorite task, actually. Now, you can play the same game we played with the visual decoder, where we can aggregate all the data together and come up with a low-dimensional space that actually describes how syntax is represented. And that's shown on these maps. So the colors here aren't really important for now. They're just different kinds of syntactic information. And you can see that different kinds of syntactic information are represented all over the brain, but
they're not random. It's not just pepper. It's organized according to areas and blobs. You can see there are large gradients. There are blobs of information. Different colors represent different kinds of semantic concepts. Some of these things are numbers. Numbers actually are represented in a lot of very specific places in the brain. Numbers oftentimes are associated or represented in the same locations or nearby locations as places and family members, interestingly enough. There's a lot of representations of emotional information. There's separate representations of static information about sort of unchanging states of the world, like this gavel is made of wood. There are all kinds of different language information, and we're going to, I think, fairly soon be able to decode this as well. And I have a demo of that, but I'll save it for the questions if somebody wants to see it. So now let's get to the fun part, which is using these encoding models to decode. This will only take about 5 minutes. Let's see how this works. So on the top shows our encoding sort of framework. We begin with a stimulus. It could be a movie or it could be a story. And we nonlinearly map it into some feature space. Remember, I showed you that word net space. And then we come up with a linear model that maps between the word net space, the feature space, and the brain, and that's our model. And we do that for each point in the brain. But once we have a model, I should mention here, bold response, you will see, is written on there. Bold means blood oxygen level dependent response. It's actually what we measure in MRI. Because remember, we're measuring blood oxygenation, not neurons. So we take all the individual points we measured bold responses from, and when we want to do decoding, we aggregate them together. We weight them by how good the model is at that point, meaning how good our predictions are. And then we can essentially project them back into this feature space or back into the stimulus space and just do decoding. It turns out that this is a completely trivial operation. It follows something called Bayes' theorem, which many of you have heard about and probably few of you care. That's perfectly fine. All you have to do is remember we went through hell to get this really complicated model to build an encoding model that describes how the brain responds to different stimuli. But then when we convert it and do decoding, so we have a stimulus and we try to predict the brain response, that's completely trivial. We basically get that for free. So if we can build a model that predicts what the brain does, we can always build a decoder, and that's going to be important later. So here's our first decoding results from a few years ago. This uses a model that takes low-level information from early visual areas and high-level information from higher visual areas and essentially combines it. And on the top are three pictures we showed people in the magnet, and on the bottom are the reconstructions of these three pictures that we got purely from brain activity. So you notice on the top left there's a little harbor scene, and the bottom left is a little harbor scene. The contrast is wrong. It's black rather than white, but it's a harbor scene. In the middle is a bunch of people standing in a room, and on the bottom in the middle is a bunch of people standing in a room with their hands in the air. And on the right is two buildings in the front, one building in the back, and on the bottom is two buildings in the front, one building in the back. So this thing works really well. In fact, it works kind of scarily well. And actually, it's not working as well as it could, because it's limited by where we got the data to do our reconstructions at the bottom. The way we did that is we actually went out to our friends at Flickr, and they gave us a hard disk with 50 million Flickr images on it. So if you use Flickr, some of your images may be on this somewhere. And we are actually decoding the pictures people saw by finding the Flickr images that are most closely related to the images that they saw. But the image that they saw is not actually in the Flickr database. So we can't reconstruct the top images perfectly. We can only find the closest match out of the database of 50 million random Flickr images that we have based on the brain activity data. Now, the thing to think about is, well, wait, what if you had 5 trillion images instead of 50 million images? Well, then we'd almost always be able to find an image that's almost exactly like the one that you saw. So this decoding is really, at this point, not limited by the brain models. It's actually limited by how much hard disk space we have, which is, you know, pretty trivial, right? This is a really interesting decoder. I will not explain anything about how this brain model works. This is something called latent Dirichlet allocation. It's a really complicated computational model developed for linguistics, but you can also use it to model how the brain categorizes natural scenes. Like this would be a lecture scene, for example, right? And you can decode information using this model as well. You can decode information according about the likely scene and the likely objects in the scene. So if you notice, on the upper left is this very unusual picture of a guy with a tarantula on his face. Now remember, this is when we built the model, pictures of people with tarantulas on their face were not in the database we used to build the model. This is a completely novel picture. So in the middle, where it says likely scene, right next to the guy with the tarantula, you see that there's some words there, and the words are land animal. Actually, I can't even see them. Land animals, few people, and this very light one means food.
So the brightness here is the probability that that category accurately represents this sea. So the brain thinks it's land animals, few people, and maybe food. And then you can decode the objects from here, man, woman, person, head, animal. Over here, this is a street scene from some city, looks maybe like Paris or somewhere else. And likely scenes are urban areas and large crowds. Likely objects are sky, car, building, road, people. That's all correct. In fact, in all these cases, they're correct. Here's a bunch of apples. The brain says this is food, and the likely objects are food, fruit, vegetables. So this thing works amazingly well. Again, this is just decoding a few higher-order brain areas using this computational model. Well, now you might think, well, if you really want to build a brain decoder, you want it to be dynamic, not static. Can you decode movies? And that's actually a challenge because remember that movies are stuff happens continuously over time. And if you recall, way back at the beginning of this talk, I told you that we're measuring blood flow, and blood flow is really slow. In fact, we're only measuring your brain once every 1 or 2 seconds. So can we recover movies? Well, it turns out we can. It involves some computational trickery, but you can essentially recover high temporal frequency information from these low temporal frequency blood flow signals. So on the upper left is the movies that we showed to people in the magnet. The three rows are the brain decoding results from three different subjects. The left-hand column is one way you could decode this brain activity. And the second column over is another way you could decode the brain activity. Both the first and second column are perfectly legitimate decodings of the picture. Now, you notice that when the picture contains, when the movie, excuse me, contains something that's really common, like a human, then we do a really good job of decoding it. But when the movie contains something abstract, like this weird ink blot thing, we do a lousy job of decoding it. And once again, the reason is, how did we build our decoder? Well, our decoder used the brain models and the brain activity, but we got the data to decode, we got the movies that we're going to decode by actually going to Google and asking them for random YouTube images. Google would not give them to us because of some legal hoo-ha. So we built a parasitizing process that basically did nothing for 6 months except steal YouTube videos at random from Google. So we downloaded 5,000 hours of video onto our computers in the lab. 5,000 hours is an interesting number because that's about a year's worth of your visual experience. You're awake for about 5,000 hours a year. So now we're trying to reconstruct the image, the movie that the person actually saw by trolling through 1 year of visual experience. If all you did was watch YouTube, which, as you know, is a bit biased. So we can reconstruct cats really well, too, by the way. And we have to reconstruct what you saw based on the YouTube video. So obviously, if we had 5 trillion hours of video, we could almost always perfectly reconstruct exactly what you saw. So this thing works really well. Now, and you can find this online. This is actually on YouTube if you want to look at it. The interesting thing that is not published anywhere yet is what happens if we try to use a high-level visual decoder. So this movie decoder is only using primary visual cortex, the earliest part of visual processing. It only knows about edges and little patches of texture and so on. It doesn't know anything about the objects, the nouns and verbs in the movies. So if we use our concept model, this word net model that I talked about with the 1,700 nouns and verbs, we get this. So on the left is the movie people watched, and on the right are 1,700 nouns and verbs that are being decoded simultaneously. And the size of the word is the probability that that thing was actually in the movie. And, of course, I can't overlay them all on top of one another, so we've just spread them out in this two-dimensional space so that you can see them. And you can see, once again, that this thing works really well. You can see it gets dog. There's a dog over there. It's man, woman, talking, face, room. Okay, it's show woman, but, you know, pretty close. This part's hard work. It switches really fast. But you'll see, here we go, the ocean scene. It's cloud, body, water, vegetation. Then we switch to Waikiki Beach, building, city, body, water, people, walking, sky, trees. There's no mountains, but these buildings are kind of mountainy. Okay, here's some, here's text. We get text. Here's two women, we get woman talking, man seems weird, oh there's the man, we just had the timing off a little bit, face, room, hand, this thing works really well. Now we switch to an ocean scene, we get fish, swim, water, body of water, ocean floor, this thing's a manatee, but we're going to have manatee in our database so it thinks it's a whale, I think that's pretty good. This thing works really well. In fact, personally this thing, since I tend to be a kind of paranoid person, this thing kind of scares me. This works really, really well. So hopefully you got the impression at this point that we can decode a lot of information from the brain. Now, if you wanted to build a brain decoder, really you'd want to decode internal speech
or something that's imaginary? Can we do that? Because, you know, here we're just showing people movies and decoding directly. So we did one experiment on that. One of my postdocs spent a week memorizing these four pictures. So he would basically sit at his desk and he would stare at a picture of the Mona Lisa, trying to form the perfect internal image of the Mona Lisa. As you know, most people are pretty lousy at visual imagery, right? And so then he would go into the magnet, and we wouldn't show him a picture of the Mona Lisa. We would just put the word up, Mona Lisa. And he would have to make a visual image of the Mona Lisa. And then we would run that whole data through our decoding algorithm to try to reconstruct the picture of the Mona Lisa, even though the Mona Lisa was not anywhere in the pictures that we showed that were available to do the reconstruction. Now, the reason this is interesting is the model we're going to use for this was the model we built by showing this guy photographs. That has to be the wrong model. Because when you look at a photograph, your brain must be doing something different than when you imagine that same photograph. If your brain did exactly the same thing in those two cases, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference, and you would be dead. You would have either been eaten by a tiger, or the modern version of a tiger, you'd get hit by a car, right? I mean, because you wouldn't know the difference between your internal imagery and the external world. So we're using the wrong model, so the question is, how well do we do in this? And actually, we do pretty well. So the Mona Lisa gets reconstructed as Salma Hayek. I think that's pretty good. The soldier gets reconstructed as a jockey. The dog gets reconstructed as a cat, or the other way around. And the vegetables get reconstructed as vegetables. So this turns out to only work about one-third as well as the decoder for actual photographs. But because that thing works so well, the decoder for imagery still works quite well. So I think this is just the early stages of brain decoding. This is, I like to think of it as an analogy to the very first photograph that was taken. This is from Joseph Nietzsche in the south of France in 1825. It's the very first photograph. And you can see that this, you know, it's not random, right? There's some buildings in the foreground. It looks like maybe there's a horizon in the background. This is a lousy photograph. But now, 200 years later, we have video that is so good people are not willing to pay for it, right? It's easy to build a TV that nobody wants. The photography has just escalated. And brain reading decoding technology is going to be the same way. Because really there's only three factors that limit your ability to decode the brain. One is, how well can you record brain activity? And as technology develops, you can come up with new methods to record brain activity all the time. They happen every 10 or 20 years, like clockwork. There's always a better way to measure brain. The second factor that limits your ability to measure, to decode the brain is your theories about the brain and your models. But of course, your government taxpayer money has pays people like me and other neuroscientists to try to figure out how the brain works. And as I showed you earlier, every time we build a better encoding model that more accurately describes how the brain works, we can use that to build a better brain decoder. So as long as NIH keeps getting funded, who knows what's going to happen in this environment, as long as NIH keeps getting funded, we're going to be able to build better brain decoders. And the third thing that limits brain decoding is how fast are your computers. But of course, there Moore's Law saves us. Computers, you know, double every couple years in power, and so we always have more powerful computers. So essentially, as long as technology keeps developing and human society flourishes, brain decoding is going to come down the pike. It's going to get more and more common. It's going to get more and more powerful. It's going to happen. And I think, from my point of view, that means that we neuroscientists and neuroethicists have to work now to try to sort of control this technology, because we don't want it getting out like Pandora's box and not being regulated or anything. I could think it could be very scary. One other interesting project that people oftentimes ask me about is, well, can you build a portable brain decoding device? So this is Dilbert's version of my experiment. Essentially, he's got a little hat that shows nasty things that he's thinking about his boss. The question is, when would you have a portable brain decoding beanie that you could just wear around? And I actually think that's certainly within our lifetimes. It's not that far away. It won't work very well at first, but I think within 10 or 20 years we could see a little portable brain decoding hat. So, for example, I like going to Japan. I don't speak Japanese, but I could just go to Japan, put on my little brain decoding hat. I'd think in English. My brain decoding hat would decode the English. It would send it to Google Translate. Google Translate would return it in Japanese, and it would just come out on a speaker on the front of my hat, and I would speak Japanese. I don't think that's far-fetched at all. I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Anyway, thank you very much for your time. I had a great time. I hope it was interesting.
Professor Galland, thank you for a very sophisticated and thought-provoking talk. I just want to remind, I have a reminder here, just a reminder to our listening audience that this Commonwealth Club is reverse engineering of the human brain by Professor Jack Gallant of University of California at Berkeley. We are run out of time. We have 65 minutes of recording time, which means that the radio recording is off now. So we will be going on to, we can continue with Q&A, but it won't be recorded for radio. So we can sit here in this room for the next X amount of time. I think 30 minutes is the maximum, but we have to make it less. And you may be able to ask Dr. Gallant if ask him questions about his talk. So I'd like to thank him again for his comments today, and we also thank you, the audience, for listening and recording, and to the recording audience. And so this is all formal. It's new to me. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.